Hi, I'm Sue.
Hi, Sue.
Very grateful member of the Al-Anon family groups because I love an alcoholic. And if you're new and sitting in this room, a new qualifier for Al-Anon. If you don't love the alcoholic you're with, Al-Anon can teach you how to do that. Because I didn't when I first got here. It must be because I didn't know it was a disease. I just thought he was stupid and crazy. And they told me that he was sick. And that I was too, yeah. And if you're new and you're sitting in here and you don't like what the alcoholic's doing, wait 5 minutes. They'll change. A newcomer at our meeting the other night, her biggest problem was is her mother's the alcoholic, and what are they going to do? Where are they having Thanksgiving? And the newcomer is going to have Thanksgiving at her house because her mother complained, being the alcoholic, of having the mess in her house last year. And she said, so she told her mother, I'll do it at my house this year. And her mother said, I don't know if I want to do that. I was thinking about going to Greece. And she goes, Greece? It's Thanksgiving. We told her not to worry about that, that, you know, by Thanksgiving, she'd be in Germany or Japan. She'll be a lot of places before Thanksgiving. Good news is most of the time they don't get there. You know, alcoholics make all these plans. That's one of the things that really made me insane. Is he would say he was going to do this, and I would try to manipulate it where he didn't do it, and he never did it. And I'd spent so much time on trying to get the roadblocks set up and everything, and then he never went that way. There were all those roadblocks over there, and he got out over here. Yeah. So, I want to thank the committee for asking Keith and I to come and share with you this weekend and for you loving on us this weekend. And I want to thank Annette. She's a good driver. She didn't get lost or nothing. I was really proud of her. I went to a conference one time and I didn't, the lady was going to pick me up, wasn't at the baggage claim when I got there. And so I went over the information, and there was an escalator there. And I'd seen this lady looking around, and I thought, well, you know, she'll come over to me because she's going to have a sign and stuff, and or she'll page me. And so I went over to information, and I said, would you please page the person that's picking up Sue Drum is right here, you know, at the information desk. And so they paged that, and I looked over, and there was this lady walking up the escalator, and when that page went over the PA system, she started walking down the up escalator, and I go, there she is. Well, that's an Al-Anon. We're so fun. Everybody's so fun. It's good to see the other people on the program here this weekend. We've known them for a while and love them to death. You know, love their time. I respect time in this program. And always try to fill my bucket up with the long-timers when I'm around them. I love them to death. From where they come from to where they are today has helped me so much. Yeah. And I want to thank our friends from Minnesota and Des Moines for being here. I love them a lot. And they come to love on us. And God's so good to us because we get to see each other two or three times a year. You know, God puts special people together, and we're all special people here today. And, you know, Keith was so funny last night. Some of you guys have come up to me and said, God, I just love to hear Keith share. I love to hear him talk. Well, I want you to know that I'm standing here right now today because listening to that stuff made me crazy for years. But he is so funny. He's my entertainment today. I love Keith. He is so funny. And he does funny things all the time. But the difference is today that I don't get embarrassed by it. Yeah. He doesn't embarrass me anymore. I just look at him, ain't he cute, and I laugh. Because he says and does things that normal people don't do and say, you know. It's funny. He has a shop and he builds motorcycles, and there's alcoholics in there all the time. And And he just loves doing that. He's retired, but he's working harder than he did when he worked. And the deal is he has alcoholics there all the time, and he just loves doing what he's doing, and I love him doing what he's doing. And here a while back, I went over there. And so I went in, and he introduced me to this guy. And he said, "This is so-and-so. He's from South Texas." And so I stuck out my hand, and I said, "Hi, I'm Sue." And he said, "Yeah, I'm from Bay City, Texas." And I said, "That is South Texas." He said, "Well, my hometown's really McLean, Texas." And I go, "Really? I was in an unmarried mother's home with a lady from McLean, Texas." And Keith starts shoving me out the shop. "Okay, Sue, we'll see you later. Bye-bye." Yeah. And so on the way out, I asked some of the guys in his home group, I said, "What's wrong with him?" And they go, "Sue, that guy's not an AA. He's a customer." I thought, whoa, paybacks or something, aren't they? Yeah. I wonder if that embarrassed him. That guy is, huh? So, because we have no secrets today, we are who we are. And we've been taught to share in a general way what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. And I'm going to try to do that. It's, I love being able to share at AA conferences because alcoholics are so funny. And we love you so much. And I'm so grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous giving Al-Anon the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous because we really needed them because we got sick too. We wouldn't have if it hadn't have been for you, but I'm grateful that you gave us a program of recovery, yeah. And alcoholics are a lot of fun, and we love you. We love you so much. We hang in. You know, I know there's a lot of people in here that when they start drinking, get in trouble and all that kind of stuff, whoever they were married to left and moved on and no problem, and they were out of there. And that's not a pre-Al-Anon. The pre-Al-Anon's are the one that hangs in and don't give up. We just don't give up. We know there's a person in there somewhere that is loving, kind, and gentle. And we're constantly looking for that person. In our literature, it talks about every time there's a sober period, we think the problem has gone away. We have so much hope that one day it's going to be okay. It's like this man that he was going to fertilize his yard. And he had a bunch of fertilizer brought in and dumped in his backyard. And he's going to plan landscaping and everything. And he had an optimistic son, and he had a pessimistic son. And the pessimistic son came up to him, and he said, "Dad, that stuff stinks like crazy." He said, "What in the heck are you doing?" He said, "It's horrible. You got to get rid of it." And the father said, "No, I'm going to plant grass, and we're going to spread it around. We're going to have a beautiful lawn, and it's going to be fine. Don't worry about it, son." He goes, "No, it's horrible. I can't stand it." And the father looks out the window, and his optimistic son's out there, and he's just digging in that fertilizer like crazy, just digging, digging, digging. And he goes out there, and he goes, "Son, what are you doing?" And the optimistic son looks at him, and he said, "Well, Daddy, I know if there's this much horse shit, there's got to be a pony in here somewhere." And that's who we are. We know there's a pony in there somewhere, you know, and we're constantly looking for the pony. But it's like I wasn't raised in an alcoholic home, and when I got to you, I was told, once you're attracted to the alcoholic personality, you will always be attracted to an alcoholic personality. And I thought I wasn't raised in an alcoholic home. I didn't know no alcoholics. I did not know about alcoholism. It had never been a problem in my house. And I looked at me, and I had to do a lot of writing about me and find out, you know, the smug and arrogance that I came in with. What's a lady like me doing in a place like this? And I did a lot of inventory work, and what I got to find out is that I had some characteristics that when I met the disease of alcoholism, they turned into flaming character defects. I already had them there. And alcoholism brought them out in me big time. You know, my dad worked in the oil fields, and we traveled all over Oklahoma in Texas Panhandle and Western Kansas for years. We live in a trailer house, and we pulled that trailer house, followed the oil wells, and I was called oil field trash a lot, and there was something in me that started believing what people would say to me. I never felt like I belonged because I'd go 5, 6, 7 schools in 1 year, and I didn't like it. And my folks finally settled down in the Texas Panhandle, and it's like I never felt like I belonged there. I wasn't a hometown girl. And I had an older sister and a younger brother. And when I was, my older sister ran off and got married and started her own family. And I was 16, and my father passed away with cancer, and that left my mother and younger brother and I at home. And my mom started partying a short period after my dad passed away, and I hated her for that because she's been disloyal to my father. And I was taking care of my little brother, and I resented that because she was going out having fun. I'm the teenager. I'm supposed to be having fun. I'm supposed to be doing the stuff, and she's doing it. And who does she think she is? And so I started looking for love in all the wrong places. And I ended up in San Antonio in an unwed mother's home. And I stayed there for a period of time, and I gave a child up for adoption. And I'm so grateful that I did that today, because I know at that time no way was I ready, willing, or able to be responsible and be a parent. And I heard something in there from a counselor that I never heard until I got to you. She said, God uses people to help other people, and God used you as an instrument to help people have a child that they couldn't have. And so I accepted that, and I went back home. And I got home, and it was like boring with the kids that I used to know and run around with. And one night my mother said to me, would you like to go to a honky-tonk? And I said, yeah, I'd like to go. Because I wouldn't have much fun with the kids because I'd learned some things while I was in there. And so I got ready and I went to that honky-tonk with her, and we walked in, and it was a room bigger than this in a Quonset building. And it was smoky. Everybody was drunk and they were rowdy. The music was loud. People were fighting and yelling at each other, and it's like, yes, I'm home. I loved everything about it. It's like, oh, wow. You know, I'd never done anything like that before, and I loved it. And I looked around the room, and I saw this cowboy, and he was starting fights, and I thought it took a lot of courage to do that. And he started this fight, and he came running past me, and he said, honey, let me know when the fight's over. And he ran in the woman's restroom to hide. And so after the fight was over, I said, okay, cowboy, you can come out now. And he came out, and it was the last dance. And usually the last dance is a slow dance where you rub up against each other and get ready to go home. But this was a fast dance, and it kept getting faster and faster and faster, and we never missed a lick, and I loved it. And as I look back on that, what I understand from that is that he got me downtown in the fast lane right now. He did for me what nothing else had ever done for me. And I understand today that the only difference between the alcoholic and the Al-Anon is that the alcoholic's obsession is the booze and mine's the boozer. And that's the only difference. It set up that obsession with me immediately. He called me the next day and asked me out. My mother said, no, you're not going out with him. He's older than you. He's been married before, and he's in trouble all the time. And I said, I don't care. Keith comes over to pick me up, and we walk outside, and there's no car. And I go, now, wait a minute. He said, you don't understand. I totaled my car, and I lost my driver's license forever. And I said, no problem. I got a car and a license. And so I got him in my car, and I knew what to do. I took him to the drive-in movie, and I knew what to do there. You kiss and smooch and steam up the windows. And we got the drive-in movie, and we sit there, and we watched the movie. And I thought, whoa, this must be what it's like to be with a more mature man. And then I noticed that he had a six-pack of beer sitting between his legs, that he was more interested in me, and that set up that obsession. I wanted to be number one in that man's life more than anything, and I started competing with alcohol from that day forward. And Keith and I started dating. Many times he wouldn't come pick me up. We'd schedule a date, and he wouldn't come and pick me up. And I'd think, now, he can't treat me like this. He doesn't know who this is. And all that smug and arrogance would come up. no training whatsoever, and I would start into this. When he gets here, I'm going to say this, and he's going to say that, or when he calls me, I'm going to tell him, and do all the what for's. And then he'll understand. And so he'd call me, and he'd go, hi. I go, where were you last night? He'd go, well, I don't know. Why? Well, we were supposed to have a date. He'd go, no problem. I'll pick you up tonight. And I'd go, okay. And then I'd be really mad, you know, because I hadn't told him all the stuff. So I thought, I'll show him. I'll show him how it feels. And so before he'd get over at my house, I'd chug-a-lug a few beers so he'd know what it felt like. He'd walk in my house and he'd look at me and he'd say, well, you're not going anywhere tonight. And I'd say, why not? And he'd say, because you're drunk. I said, I go with you when you're drunk. He'd say, I know. You hang out with drunks, I don't. Yeah. And that's the way it was. Yeah. And he was so funny. He used to have long hair and a long beard, and I hated that. I did not like long hair and long beards. And I would bug him about getting a haircut and a shave. The more I bugged him about it, the worse it got. And he was coming over during the week to watch TV with me, and my girlfriends would talk to me about him, their boyfriends coming over and doting on them. And they'd sit on the couch and smooch, and my boyfriend was coming over and falling asleep. I did not understand pass out. I did not understand the disease of alcoholism. And I thought, well, I got to change this. I'll show him the sweet taste of revenge. God, I lived on that for years. So one night Keith came over and he went to sleep on me, and you're not going to treat me this way again. I'm going to show you. And I got a razor and I shaved off half his head and half his face. And he got up and he went home. He came back the next day to take me out and he looked the same. And he went around like that for 2 weeks. And we'd drag Main Street. Go down this way, clean shaven. He'd turn around, we'd drag him to be along. And he'd say, the people in this town think I'm two-faced anyway. And I would just laugh and giggle. I thought he was so funny. Yeah. And we used to go across the Oklahoma Panhandle up into Kansas to these honky-tonks up there because you could drink out of the packages, you know, get packaged liquor and drink out of them. And so we'd go up there to the honky-tonks and went up there one night, and he wasn't paying attention to me, and I know how to make a man pay attention to me. You flirt with somebody else, and when he sees them paying attention to me, then he'll pay more attention to me. I didn't know alcoholics worked in opposites, and he just got really mad at me. And we got in a fight, and we were leaving, and who's going to drive, and he won. And so we start out toward Texas, and we get to the Oklahoma state line, and they have radar set up there. And he said, oh, my gosh, if they catch me, I'll never see the sun again. And I said, no problem. I've never had a ticket. So we switched places in that car going 100 miles an hour. But there's nothing wrong with me yet. And we got down at the end of the other state line before you go into Texas, and they had a roadblock set up there for us. And the highway patrol came up to the window and said, we don't know how you got under this wheel because you weren't there when we clocked you before. But we've checked on this car and it's been reported stolen. And so we're going to take you both in. And Keith smarted off the cops and they handcuffed him and put him in the sheriff's car. And they told me to follow him 40 miles to the county seat so they could arrest me. So I did. And we get there and they're fingerprinting and booking me. And they said, you can make one phone call. And Keith said, I want to talk to the district attorney. And I'm being fingerprinted in a book, and I'm thinking, oh, my gosh, this man goes straight to the top. I am so impressed. And so he makes a phone call, and pretty soon this guy comes in, and he's an older man with mature gray hair. And he was really cool. He had on a coat with a fur collar turned up, you know, and he looked really good. And I was immediately attracted to him. Today I know it's because he's an alcoholic. And Keith introduced me to my future father-in-law. So I was in custody of my future father-in-law when we first started dating. But there's nothing wrong with me. You know, I did not know that alcoholism is a disease. I did not know that I was contacting that disease. And I did not know any of those things Nobody taught me how to do any of those things, how to start taking the rap, how to cover up for him, how to do this or that. It came natural for me. And, you know, I think it's so funny because my sponsor says, you know, if we kicked everybody out of Al-Anon that had drank and used with an alcoholic, we wouldn't have a membership. And it is so true because I am so grateful today that I don't have the phenomena craving. I think it's so important that for Al-Anons to read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not in a meeting, but on your own. It's not conference-approved literature. But our literature says to learn everything we can about the disease of alcoholism, and I think it's so important. And I don't know a better reference point than to find the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm grateful to the long-timers in this program that raised me on that book because it told me a lot. It told me about me. It says no human power can relieve their alcoholism and that God could and would if he was sought. And I did a lot of damage in our family and in our marriage and with my daughter over and over and over again thinking I had the answers that I knew. I had to have the answers because the disease of alcoholism in Keith is starting to tell me that I am stupid. And that I'm dumb and that I don't know this and I don't know that. And the disease in me is starting to believe the disease in him. And so I have to know everything. I mean, he came over at my house one time and he'd been in a fight. I didn't know he'd been in a fight and his jaw was hurting. He said it feels like it's knocked off kilter and all this kind of stuff. And I don't know what's wrong with me. Can you look at my jaw and see what's wrong with me? And I had to have the answer. And I told him I thought he had polio of the teeth. Yeah. I had to have an answer because I couldn't be stupid. You know, Keith had been to school for many years, and his folks and I decided he needed to go back to school. And so, you know, Keith and I ran off to Amarillo, Texas, and got married because he'd gotten a draft notice. And then the next weekend, Uncle Sam didn't want him, so I got to keep him. And then we decided that he needed to go back to school, and we moved to Oklahoma. And shortly after we got there, we had our daughter, Simone. And I can remember looking at her and thinking, thank God she's a girl. Because Keith's a drunk, his dad's a drunk, and his granddad's a town drunk. If we have a boy, he'll carry on the family tradition. I did not know that alcoholism doesn't care what sex, color, race, or creed you are. It'll take you to the gates of insanity and hell, and you don't even have to drink booze to get there. Alcoholism is a family disease, and it affects everybody in the family, the non-drinkers, the children, everybody. And I'm so grateful I know that today. And we have to do everything that we have to do in order to hit a bottom, in order to get here. And I believe that every non-drinker has to hit a bottom in order to get to Al-Anon. You see, I don't believe that being married to an alcoholic is makes me an Al-Anon. Being affected by the disease of alcoholism and recognizing that I need help and going to a program called Al-Anon Family Groups, getting a sponsor, working the steps, and giving this thing away makes me an Al-Anon. When Keith went in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for those 4 years, he used to be a drunk. And then he started going to AA. And then I'd call him an alcoholic, and that would make him furious. And so I understand today that alcoholics are only people sitting in rooms like this. Drunks don't come in here. And I understand today that we can't call anybody an alcoholic unless they call themselves that. We have a newcomer in our group right now that wants her husband to call himself an alcoholic and he's drinking really bad. And she's complaining because he's not responsible and he can't do anything. And so the other night he was going to make stir fry for dinner and he said, because I make the best stir fry and I know you like it and you're going to these meetings and you're trying to change and I want to help you. So I'm going to fix dinner so you can get to your meeting. He loves her going to meetings, but she doesn't like him being drunk. And so he put stuff in the skillet on the stove and she went by and turned the stove up and walked on. It started burning, and he went in there, what's happening? And she said, you can't do anything right. You're too drunk. She totally set him up for failure. robbing that man of his dignity. And I identify with that. I used to do those kind of things to Keith, only mine was in a more violent way. You know, I don't know why. Keith and I were both very physically violent people. The disease of alcoholism brought out a rage in me that nothing else had ever brought out in me. And I had to fight it with all the vengeance I had. And after Keith and I got married, we started fighting because the disease progressed. And I'd get in his face, we'd do things, and I'd get in his face and shake the finger, you can't do this, you can't do that. And he'd say, Sue, get out of my face. And I'd take one step closer, and I'd start in shaking that finger and yelling at him again because he had to know what I was saying. He'd say, if you don't get out of my face, I'm going to hit you. And I'd take one step closer, and the knockdown, dragout, and fight was on. You see, when I did an inventory, I used to blame Keith for being mean. But when I did an inventory, I had to look at me when I did the four-column inventory outlined in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was responsible for the violence in that house. He would tell me, leave me alone. He would tell me, get out of my face, and I would test him. And then he'd hit me, and I loved it when he hit me because it always in the very beginning, I remember the first time we got in a big fight like that, and I couldn't give up, and he couldn't either. And he had me on the bed, and he's got his hands around my throat, and he's choking the living tar out of me. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, I'm going to die. I'm literally going to die here. And I looked up in Keith's face, and he's looking down at me with all the intensity he has. And it dawned on me. He's not thinking about nothing but me. I am number one in his life. And I would start those circumstances like that all the time because it was the only time I could get 100% of his attention. And I craved it. I craved it. I believe just like the alcoholic craves alcohol. I craved his attention. And I had to be number one in his life, and I competed with alcohol. And like he shared last night, you know, he liked guns. He fought with guns, and I hated that because they shoot things you don't want them to shoot. And it's like, I'll show you. And I picked up a butcher knife, and I started fighting back with my butcher knife because I didn't know what else to do. It's the progression of the disease of alcoholism that I can make you stop. And he'd come home, and we'd get in that fight, and he'd pass out on the bed face down one time. Almost a fatal mistake for him because he was ignoring me, and you don't ignore me when I'm talking to you. And I got my butcher knife, and he's laying there sleeping. And I took that butcher knife, and I started stabbing him all over the back with that butcher knife, saying, God, please help. Please help me do away with this. I didn't know that this that I was dealing with was the disease of alcoholism. And then I go, oh my gosh, what is wrong with me? What is wrong with me? This is the man I'm supposed to love, and I'm trying to kill him. And I laid down and I cried myself to sleep. My God, what's happening to me? And the next morning we wake up and Keith goes, oh my God, something's wrong with my back. And I said, well, let me look at it. And I peeled his T-shirt up, and I looked at it, and I said, you've been drinking all that rot gut whiskey. You've got acne in the back. But don't worry, honey. I'll get the rubbing alcohol, and I'll fix it. And I loved it. I loved every ooh and aah. We tried to the best of our ability to do the right things, to be normal. You know, and he shared with you the trip from Oklahoma to California, which was crazy. And it took us 30 days to get there. And we were insane one day at a time for 30 days. And we get to California, and it's going to be different out here. It's going to be different out here. And he had told me to get me to move to California. He said, babe, when we get to California, you don't have to go to these honky-tonks anymore. You don't ever have to drink out of a paper sack anymore. You don't ever have to get in those fights anymore. Because, you see, I started in on the fighting deal with him. You don't flirt with my man. You know, I got in a fight with a girl one night because she was flirting with Keith, and you don't mess with my property. And I threw her through a plate glass window, one of those honky-tonks. And they came and got her and took her to the hospital, and she didn't come back for about 6 weeks. And she walked in that place one night, and she said, "Look at my face, what you did to me." They had to take skin off my hip to graft my face back together. No guilt and remorse there at all. I said, "Fine. From now on, we'll just call you Buttface." That's the kind of person I was. No compassion, no feelings for anybody else. She deserved it because she was messing with my man. And I don't ever want to be that kind of lady again. So I know about the disease of alcoholism and how it progresses. And when, you know, Keith was saying you don't have to go in those fights anymore, you know. He said, you can go to a restaurant in California and order a cocktail. And you can be a lady out there, Sue. Oh, my gosh. I wanted to be a lady more than anything. I didn't know how to be. And so when we moved to California and got all of our stuff out there and got moved in, and Keith had started working in the oil fields and he'd be gone. And one Friday night he came home and he said, "Would you like to go to dinner?" And I said, "Oh, yeah." We'd been waiting. So we hurry up and get all dressed up, and we go, and we drive up in front of this brick building. It's not a Quonset hut that has Rosie's painted on the window. It's not a place that has a board with Shangri-La carved across the door. It's a nice place, and people are dressed up. And they are nice, classy people, and God, I'm going to be okay in here. It has cocktail on neon sign on the building. And God, I am so impressed. I want to be a lady. I want to be in there. I want to be like those people. And so we go in there and they seat us and they came over and they said, "Would you like a cocktail before dinner?" And I said, "You bet." And we didn't leave Simone out at all. We ordered a Shirley Temple for her. And they came and they set those drinks down in front of us. And Keith picked up his drink and he said, "Babe, let's toast to the good life." And I'm going, yeah, because that's the way it's going to be now. We're going to be okay. And so we toasted to the good life. And then he started ordering more. He ordered 10 to my one. I knew exactly how many he had. And then the waiter came over and he asked us for our order. And he said, "Would you like wine with your dinner?" I said, "Oh, yeah." Because, you see, I'd watched those people in there, and they had these long-stemmed crystal glasses, and they were swishing it and sniffing it. I didn't know what in the heck they were doing that for, but I wanted to be like that because they look classy. Because growing up in a trailer house, you don't have fine china and crystal, and you're not classy people. You're all field trash, and I want to be like them. And that's going to make me like them. Because, you see, I was always judging my insides with your outsides. If I could just feel the way you looked, I'd be okay. I had to come to you to find out that happiness is an inside job. And so we said, yeah, we wanted wine with our dinner. And so they brought the wine over. They set the glasses down, and it's like, oh, yeah. And they pour Keith just a little bit, and he says, "Is it okay?" And I looked at him and I said, "What do you mean, is it okay? He drank stuff in Oklahoma, had things floating in it. Pour mine." And he poured mine. And I sat there in all of my smug and arrogance and I swished it and I sniffed it. Oh my God, I was a lady. For the first time in my life, I felt like a lady. And I look across the table at Keith and he's drinking out of the carafe. And I yell at him, "What are you doing?" And he yells back at me, "I'm drinking. What's it look like I'm doing?" And Simone slides under the table and said, "Not here." And I see the waiter and I yell and I holler and I'm, come here, right now, come here, right now. And I don't ever want to forget this. Because you see, it's me. And he walks over to our table and he said, "I'm sorry." He said, "You're not eating here." And I said, "And why not?" He said, "Because you don't know how to act." Oh my gosh, you don't understand. It's not me. If he wouldn't be acting like that, I wouldn't be like this. You don't understand. constantly blaming my actions on somebody else, not being responsible for me. And so we're being escorted out of that restaurant, and we can never go back again because Keith's talking to everybody in sign language. And we get home, and I get right in his face, and he says, "Get out of my face." And I take one step closer, and the knockdown, drag-out fight's on. And we did that all the time. And when Simone, when Keith would get tired of fighting with me, he'd walk away and Simone would be standing there, and I had that rage inside of me and I didn't know what to do with it. I can't quit. I'm not ready to quit yet. Don't you understand? And I couldn't see nothing. It's like a fog. And I'd turn around and Simone would be there and I'd take the rest of that rage out on her. Because you see, it's a family disease. And I didn't have any answers. And we went through a lot of stuff, you know. We'd put Keith in jail, call the cops, and they'd come get him, take him to jail. The neighbor would call the cops. The cops were at our house all the time. They came one time, and Keith and I had been fighting, and I couldn't get my butcher knife, and he had the gun, so I picked up the holster, and I started beating him with the holster, and the cops drove up. They go, "What's going on here?" And he hid the gun, of course, when the cops came out. And Keith said, "I don't know. Look at her." Isn't that cute? And they go, "Where's the gun?" And I said, "I don't know. He had the gun. He hid the gun. This holster's my weapon." And they're going, "Yeah, right." So I had to give them a demo. And they put the handcuffs on me. I was the crazy one, not him. I was the crazy one. Yeah. It is the denial in the non-drinker with this disease is so overwhelming. I went to a meeting a few years ago, and I've never forgotten this. And I shared at that meeting, and afterwards this lady came up to me, and she said, "Oh my gosh," she said, "my home is just like yours. My husband and I fight just like you do." And I said, "You get in his face?" And she said, "No. My husband is so mean, I don't get in his face. I don't do anything." And I said, "I don't believe that." She said, "It's true." She said, "But I'd like for my husband to meet you. He's over in the AA meeting." And she said, "He's only been sober a couple of weeks, and he won't believe this, that we're so much alike." She said, "Can you wait here and I'll go get him?" And I said, "Sure." And so she goes, gets her husband, and she comes over, and she takes his arm and sticks his hand out to shake my hand. And I said, "What are you doing?" She said, "He's blind." And I said, "And you're not getting in his face? He's got to find you before he can hit you." You know, the denial that we come in with is unreal. And I know that I had to do everything that I had to do in order to find you, in order to find God. And I know that my God loved me enough to let me go through everything that I went through so I could find you. In order for me to hit a bottom, to be willing to come in here and do life somebody else's way. True surrender. And I don't ever want to forget the last drunk. And Keith came home and we left. We got in a big fight. And we was always leaving each other, taking turns who was going to divorce who. That's how I got him, I thought, 4 years earlier, how I got to go to take him to Alcoholics Anonymous. But see, when I hit my bottom, that wasn't the answer. That didn't work. He was in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for 4 years, and like he shared last night, when he would go to that AA meeting that I took him to and made him stay in there, because I was sitting in my car with my butcher knife, said, "If you come out before 10 o'clock, I'll gut you." Power. I had the power. So I knew that AA didn't work. And I had no answers. And I was tired. I was so tired. And the last drunk Keith was, he had turned on Simone, and he was doing the things to her that I'd always done for her. And it had happened before, but it was like, this is the first time I'd ever seen it. Like a moment of clarity. And a feeling came over me, a calmness of nothingness that I'd never felt before in my life. And I looked at Keith and I said, Keith, I don't love you anymore. But I don't hate you either. And if you got to become a skid row bum, because that's what I thought happened to drunks, and that's what you got to do. But we ain't going there with you anymore. I'm done. And Simone and I got some things together, and we walked out of that house for the very last time. And I am so grateful. I don't remember what happened in the next 4 days. But I do remember sitting in a corner of an empty room somewhere. And I'm rocking in the corner, and a little 13-year-old girl standing there patting me on the shoulder saying, Mommy, it's going to be okay. The child's comforting the parent. And she said, Mommy, I need some things for school. I gotta go home. I gotta get some things for school. I was so wrapped up in the disease of alcoholism and my obsession for Keith and his drinking that I was 3 or 4 years in this program where I was telling that story. And later Simone said, Mom, do you know why I had to go back home and get stuff? And I said, for school. And she goes, no, I was trying out for cheerleader. And I didn't even know it. That child had no support from her parents to do things that she wanted to do. Or try to be good, or try to be right, or try to get involved in her school functions. Alcoholism is a family disease. So I finally said, okay, and Simone and I got in the car and we went back to the house and we didn't know what we was going to find. We were afraid. It was dark because Keith was always shooting stuff with his guns. And he had shot a dog. Simone had brought a shaggy hog, a little cocker spaniel dog home one time, and it was looking her in the face. And Keith jumped up from what I know was a blackout, said, you can't love anything more than you love me. And he shot that dog right in our living room. Nobody cried. Because you see, if you show any weakness, you might be next. And so that was the kind of insanity we lived in on a regular basis. You had to be strong. You couldn't show weakness. And Keith was always committing suicide. He had sit in his recliner after he'd come home from a big bender and he'd wind down with Red Mountain wine and he'd shot off a sawed-off shotgun. And he'd sit in that recliner and it was one of those jackback kind that his granddad gave him and he'd put it on the floor, put his toe on the trigger and he'd click the trigger with it in his mouth. That made me crazy. I got so tired of watching that I put a shell in that gun. I'll show him this time. And the next time he came home and he did that and he jacked that gun back and he goes, what the heck? And he saw the red bullet in there, thank God, the shell. And he pulled it over the side and he clicked it and it killed our air conditioner. And we had a big fight because he killed the air conditioner. So walking up to that house that night, we didn't know what we was going to find. And we walked in there, and we looked around, and we found Keith face down on the bedroom floor. We thought he was dead, so we kicked him. And he rolled over, and he said, Sue, please help. And I know this is when a God moved into my life, because he gave me the words. One important word that I could never say to that man. And it had to come from a power greater than myself. And I looked at Keith and I said, no. No, I can't help you. If you want help, you help yourself. I don't know where that came from. You see, once, and he got up off the floor and he called Alcoholics Anonymous for himself. And what I understand today is that once I took off my God suit and I got out of the way and I let God and booze do for a drunk what nothing else can do, He reached out for Alcoholics Anonymous for himself. He hit a bottom for himself. He wanted to quit for himself. And I understand today that an alcoholic can't quit drinking for anybody but themselves. They have to have the desire to stop drinking. No human power can relieve their alcoholism. And we fought with a gun and knife one more time because that's who we are. And then doorbell rang and little Jack Callahan came. Was at our door, a little gray-headed, shriveled-up man. And I'm thinking, why don't they send the big ones on these trips? And he walked in and he did the classic 12-step call in our home. Took Keith to the detox, asked me to go with him. And then he took me back home and he said, sat in the driveway with me and he said, you need help. And I said, no, you don't. You don't understand. If he'll quit drinking, I'll be just fine. He said, no, I don't think so, Sue. He said, I haven't heard anything but trash come out of your mouth all night long. And he said, you need help. There's a program for you called Al-Anon. And he said, you need to go there and you need help. It's for family, friends, and spouses of alcoholics. He said, I think Keith's found something here now. He said, I've seen him around AA and something's happened to him, and I think he wants it this time, but he'll never make it going home to an old idea, and you're an old idea. And I understand that today, that a sober alcoholic can't stay sober in an environment they used to drink in. You see, when I'd take him to Alcoholics Anonymous before, sit out in the parking lot with my butcher knife, there was an Al-Anon meeting in that church at the exact same time. But you see, I hadn't hit a bottom. I hadn't gotten to the want to. And what I understand today is that this program is for people who want it, not for people who need it. There's a lot of people that come in here for relief. But I came for recovery. And that's the difference between the long-timers and the short-timers, is relief and recovery. And I am so grateful that I hit a bottom strong enough, or low enough, or whatever you want to call it, that I knew that I came for recovery. There hasn't been one day in the last 28 and a half years that I've thought of running. A lot of people share in meetings, well, I wanted to run away. To where? Because I understand that if I run, I will become the same person I used to be. My past is my greatest asset. I don't ever want to go back being that lady that I used to be. And I've got reference points in my life of what I used to be. And so Jack went in the house and he told Simone, if you love your daddy and you want to help him, the only way you can help him is go to a program called Alateen. And we started going once a week. He got out of detox and he was going every day. He needed to. He was sicker than us. But after 6 weeks of going to one meeting a week, he wasn't home when he was supposed to be. And by God, he's got a mind now. He's sober. And I'm thinking all this stuff. And I thought, I got to remember some things I heard in these meetings. And so I thought, I got to relax. So I made a warm bath, and I thought, I'll sit in there and I'll relax, and I'll think of some of those things I heard in the meetings. Now, this is how well I was getting on one meeting a week. I sit there and I relaxed and I thought, whoa, I know he's down at a coffee shop with at least 6 sober alcoholics right now. I could kill him today and he'd have pallbearers. That's how well I was getting on one meeting a week. Keith came home and I was right in his face. Don't you do this to us. You're sober now. You can't do this. Blah, blah, blah. And he said, get out of my face. And I took one step closer and I'm just letting him have it. And he said the most devastating thing to me he'd ever said to me. Sue, get out of my face. I can't hit you anymore and stay sober. My sobriety comes first. You're going to have to fix yourself. Whoa, I went crazy. And I ran down the hallway and I ran in the bathroom and whirled around, slammed the door. And as I did that, I saw a crazy woman in the mirror. And the words came to me, and one more time, I know it was my God. One meeting a week is not going to fix you. And I know today, 2 meetings a week I can uncomfortably maintain in 3 or more meetings a week, I want to grow. And so I started putting my 2 biggest character defects into assets in my life, greed and impatience. The more I go, the more I get. Right now. I wanted this thing right now. Never fought it. And today I go 4 or 5 meetings a week. And I love it. And I don't go because I have to anymore. I go because I want to. I want to keep what I got. I want to keep listening to what you've got to say. I want to keep hearing what the newcomers are sharing so I won't forget where I came from. I want to talk to the newcomers. I want to get in sponsor. I want to sponsor people. I want to be able to give this thing away because it's like I can hear myself talking to a newcomer. And she'll go, oh, yeah. And I think, yeah, that was really good. I got to remember this stuff. You know? It's both of us that are benefiting. And my sponsor took me through the steps and I got into recovery and I got into service. But one of the things of service that I got into that I love more than anything else is that Al-Anon was trying to get a panel into a woman's prison out in Chino. And finally this lady got it. And she asked me to go on this panel with her. And we went in there. And there were 3 other ladies with us. And when I shared, I was the last one in there to share. And the other ladies, they hadn't hit a bottom like I'd hit in this before I got here. And after I shared, those inmates going, whoa, 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 whoa. And Diana looked at me and she said, Sue, this is your panel. They don't identify with me. And I've had that panel in there for 20 years. Never missed a meeting, never a dark night. And ladies from my home group go in there with me. They have a no hostage policy in there. And they had a lockdown one time in an Al-Anon meeting because they were using drugs in an Al-Anon meeting. Can you imagine that? Made me mad. I didn't know what was going on, but I couldn't keep their attention, so we shut the meeting down early, and here came in all the guards and started taking them out 6 at a time. And I go, what's going on? And they said, they're using drugs in here. I go, in my Al-Anon meeting? And this one little gal that was with me, she goes, oh my gosh, Sue, if they take one of us hostage, there's a no hostage policy in here. What do you do? She said, I know, I'm going to borrow your God. You got a strong God. And I said, no, no, he's working for me tonight. Get your own. She goes, what do we do if they take us hostage? I said, love the one you're with. And they were very hostile in the very beginning. And it took about at least 5 years for them to learn trust. And, oh my God. They have their own step study meetings in there now. And AA had always been in there. NA's in there. And a year after I had my panel, Keith got a panel in there, and they love Keith to death. They have a Christmas banquet for AANA and Al-Anon. I was the first Al-Anon ever invited to their Christmas banquet. And I felt so honored to go to a prison banquet. Three years ago, they had Keith go to the front of the room and they set him in a chair. 6 of the inmates, 3 of them, the Manson girls, set him down and they sang Mr. Big Stuff to him and named him Man of the Year at CIW. And my sponsor gave me a bumper sticker that says my husband was Man of the Year at California Institute for Women. Forget all those honor students out there. And I love those women. I love them. And I know they love me. And we've taken Simone in there. And she's come home from, she lives in Italy today, has for a long time as a model. And she's married and has a family now. We have a 6-year-old granddaughter. And she used to, when she'd come home, she'd say, "What do you want for Christmas, Mom?" And I'd say, "I want you to go to CIW with me." And she said, "You're the only mom in the world that wants her daughter to go to prison." And I love it in there. I've been treated for 7 years for sciatica. This year I went to the doctor and I found out that I didn't have a hip. It wasn't sciatica at all. And so I was scheduled for surgery to get a new hip. And the doc said, "You'll probably feel bad for at least a couple of weeks." So I looked at my calendar and I called the doctor's office and I said, "Tell the doctor he can operate on me on April the 26th. I've got 2 weeks off." And the nurse laughed. So did my sponsor when I told her I was telling the doctor when he could operate on me. And the nurse said, "It doesn't work that way." And I was worried about my commitments in this program. How can I do that and shut you off? Because he said, "You're going to need time to recover. You're not going to be able to be active." Oh my God, for me to not be active is a huge surrender for me. And what am I going to do with my commitments? And so I told him, I said, "You know, let me call back. I got to look at my calendar." And I looked at my calendar and I had nothing on my calendar from June 22nd through the end of September. And I go, "God, thank you. You knew when good timing was." So I called him back and I said, "I can do anything from June the 22nd on through September, but I'd really like to have it as close to July 1st as possible." Because I knew I needed at least 2 months recovery time. And so they called me back and they said July 1st. And I went in that prison and I shared with those inmates that I was going to go through that and that I was going to do that. And they said, "When, Sue?" I said, "At 7:30 a.m. on July 1st. And they said, "We will all be praying for you." And I knew they would. 120 women. And I had a lot of prayers from people. But when I went in that surgery room and the doctor came in and he said, "Are you ready?" I said, "Yes, CIW and I are ready." Because I knew a lot of people, a lot of you had said, "We'll say prayers for you," and I knew you would. But I knew the dedication that those inmates have to recovery. And I had faith in them that they were all going to pray for me. And the girls handled the panel for the 2 months that I couldn't go out there, girls in my home group. And I went out there last month. And I walked in the room and they all stood up and clapped and said, "We love you. We knew you would be back in here." They have faith and they have hope through examples that they've seen of people in recovery that go in there. They love Keith and I. Keith was a woman hater when he got to this program. And they have literally loved him back to health and helped him understand women. And I love him so much for that. We have a good life today because of service in this program and working with others. Because you never gave up on us. Because sponsors never gave up on us. Like he said last night, the most important words in our house is, "My sponsor says." The other three words that are just as important is, "Call your sponsor." Yeah. Doesn't matter who's saying it. It works. It works in our home. Simone stayed active in Al-Anon. In Alateen, made the transition into Al-Anon, and she moved to Italy. She followed a dream of being a model 20 years ago, and she modeled over there, very successful, but she was very instrumental in starting a lot of things in Al-Anon over there. Still involved in Al-Anon. Sponsors a lot of ladies. She got married 10 years ago to a full-blooded Italian. Very nice man. Very Italian. we love him because he loves her. He takes very good care of her. And 5.5 years ago, they had our granddaughter, Nicole. They did not have their daughter. They had our granddaughter, Nicole. I got to go over there when that little girl was born because you taught me how to be a mother. What a gift. One more time, when I felt that baby, I knew God was alive. You see, I felt that going into that prison. I have felt that holding a newcomer. And I felt that when my granddaughter was born. And she's the light of our life. The first time Simone brought her home, well, she'd come over before, but when the first time after she started trying to talk and Simone brought her home, she's about 18 months, and we went to the airport to get him. Simone was trying to get her to say grandmama and grandpapa because her in-laws are very proper Italians. And Nicole wouldn't say nothing. And so we got home, we ate, and Keith went and got his jacket, and he was going to go to his AA meeting. And Nicole looked at him, and she ran out and grabbed a hold of his leg. "No, Pappy, no." We're going, "Oh, my God, you're Pappy." You know? And Keith picked her up and hugged her and stuff, and we're all crying because she named him Pappy, and how cool, you know? So Keith leaves, go to the AA meeting, and I tell Simone, "Take her in the other room and let me get my coat." And so I get my coat, and I said, "Okay, Simone." Simone brings her out, and I go, "Ciao, ciao, Nicole, ciao, ciao." And she looks at me, and she says, "Ciao, ciao." Not self-obsessed, am I? Yeah. But she lights up our life. She finally started calling me Granny. And this last June when they were home, you know, I tease her and I call her my doodlebug. And she says, "No, Granny, you're doodlebug and I am your butterfly." Because she knows I love butterflies. And so we talk to him on the phone a lot. And she'll say, "Granny's my butterfly, my doodlebug." And I'll go, "Nicole is my butterfly." And I'll say, "Who loves you?" And she'll go, "Granny." And I go, "That's right." And she'll go, "And don't you forget it." And we have a great love affair. She loves her pappy. She's not afraid of her pappy. You guys have seen her pappy. You know what, tattoos and the whole bit. She's not afraid of her pappy. Because you guys have made us loving, gentle people. You've done that through putting newcomers in our life in the 12 steps of this program. And when she was 3 years old and they'd been here to see us and they went back home, Simone said she'd put her down for her nap. And she told Nicole, "You got it." She heard her in there and she'd hear this ch-ch-ch-ch-ch. And she'd say, "Nicole, if you don't take your nap, we're not going to go to the park this afternoon." And so she said, "Be quiet for a while." And then she'd hear this ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch. And so she opened the door and she went in there. And Nicole had taken a Pentel pen and made circles and faces and lines all over her arms and her legs. She had taken it and made streaks on her chin like she had a beard. And she looked at Simone and she says, "I'm Pappy." What a gift of love. Simone said, "I didn't know whether to laugh or scream." And she said, "But I knew she wasn't afraid of her Pappy. I knew she didn't know the man that was my dad. I knew she knew the man that's in Alcoholics Anonymous." And she said, "I know she knows you as a grandma that practiced the program of Al-Anon. We have so much to be grateful for because of you. I will never know how to repay this thing back to you. I shared in the very beginning that God uses people to help other people. The only way I know how to share it is a story that I always close with. And there was a little boy laying in his room one night, and there was thunder and lightning and hail outside, and he got scared, and he ran and got in bed with his mom and dad. And he laid next to his dad, and he was shivering. His dad put his arm around him, and he goes, "Son, what's wrong with you?" And his dad, the little boy, says, "Daddy, I was in my bedroom, and there's thunder and lightning outside, and I got scared, and I was in there, I was alone, and I was afraid." And the dad cuddled him up, and he goes, "Son, you didn't have to be afraid in there. You weren't alone. God was in there with you." And the little boy looked up at his daddy, and he said, "Yeah, I know, Daddy, but right now I need something with skin on it." "And you see, you're my God with skin on it. And I will always be grateful to you for that. Thank you very much."